afternoon. Un gran placer estar aquí. And I want to thank Rosemary for being our hostess, but also for bringing us together. And she is a woman of tremendous integrity, and we are very proud to have her at the IOM. Because and it's a tremendous pleasure for me to be with wonderful colleagues like Hortensia and Margarita. And I think you'll find some common themes here. This is a picture of me. I was born in Argentina. And when you turn 8 in Argentina, you have a card that's your identity card. And you can see that my last name was Jaluzinski, which is a 13-letter Polish name. My father was German, and he left Germany in 1939. And he had wanted to come to America, where, as you know, the streets are paved with gold. And unfortunately, the Americans wouldn't let him in. So the only places that he ended up originally was Bolivia, and then he didn't like Bolivia, so he moved to Argentina, where he met my mother, who had been born in Argentina, but of Polish parents who had been thrown out of Poland through one of the Jewish pogroms. So I feel that in some ways I've had double culture of both being a Latina woman and a Jewish woman simultaneously facing a number of experiences that I will share with you. But I want to say that that as soon as we came to this country, my father changed his last name, our last name, from Jaluzinski to Dale, because he loved Dale Carnegie. And he loved hills and dales. And so I became Claire Dale. And at the time, I came in the late 50s, Clarabelle was the popular TV show. That was you can go on YouTube and find some Clarabelles. But I was teased, and I was really bullied. And so I'm very empathetic with the whole movement today about anti-bullying, because it clearly had a big impact on me. But I would say that my favorite memory as an 8-and-a-half-year-old was coming by ship. My dad had the luxury of coming to this country, finding a job, because he was German. He did not want to bring his family unless he had a job and he had a house or an apartment or something. And we lived in Cleveland, Ohio, which was an incredibly difficult culture shock to go from Latin America to Cleveland, Ohio, because our American sponsors promised the U.S. government that we would not be dependent on welfare. And as a result, my father had 4 different jobs, and my mother started sewing. My little brother was born in Cleveland. And so we had these very difficult entry points into this country. Now I'm doing research with undocumented DACA youth. DACAs are the deferred action childhood arrivals. And I truly share with you that though I'd never had the pain of being undocumented, in many regards, you have some common understandings of being marginalized, being living in the shadows, and being really not part of it. So I was very blessed to have 2 parents who really saw the new country as the place where they were going to raise their children. And I was very blessed that though they never went to college, I was the first one to go to college in my family. And at UCSF, at the University of California, San Francisco, if I was wearing my UCSF ID versus my APHA ID, I have a pin on it, which is FG, proud to be FG2C. So at our campus, we have identified faculty members who are the first to go to college. And we are linked up. Our school is very unusual because it has only 4 campuses. It has a school of nursing, pharmacy, dentistry, and medicine. So at the very beginning of the year, we come together with all the first-timers who are now the undergrads, you know, who are in medical school, nursing school, et cetera, and to create a bridge between the faculty who have made it and the faculty of the future. And I share that with you because it's not an expensive program, but it is a very important program. And so some of us are involved in mentoring. Some of us are involved in some social events throughout the year. But just so that even though the students know that there's someone there. Even before coming to this country, and I would say that the favorite experience I had was waking up, because my mother and I came by ship, and it took many, many days to come from Buenos Aires to New York Harbor, and I was woken up at dawn to look at the Statue of Liberty. And I still have this tremendous optimism about our country, in spite of all its limitations, in spite of all its problems, this pull that we see from the immigrant populations, whether it be Latino, whether it be from Soviet Union, whether it be from Asian, it is a pull to this country that is very important. And we need to understand that the issues of acculturation and assimilation are extremely complex. They're not just, did you speak Spanish or did you speak English at home? And the historical moment in which people come to this country, under what circumstances do people come to this country? Are we embracing the braceros who come and pick our fields, or are we jailing and rejecting, or as last year where we deported over 400,000 Latinos back to Mexico? So I just want to say that it's very important what you heard across the panel around the fact of history and the generation. And I'm a very proud 1.5 generation, that the 1.5ers are those who came to this country before the age of 14, before the age of 8 and between the ages 8 and 14, are walking the trapeze between being of the old country and being of the new country, but being able to navigate successfully. And I do feel that that has been a very sharp influence in my life around seeing it from a Latina lens, all that goes on, while also understanding the challenges of this country. And my idealism and sense of deep social justice began long before even arriving to this country, and I've been very, very fortunate that I've had an opportunity to be here. So I'm sharing with you a few of my insights about myself in the same way you've heard about some lessons learned. And I've shared initially how helpful my parents were to me, and I wish my parents were alive to see my having been elected to the IOM. That was one moment that I really deeply, deeply missed them, because that would have been such an important symbolic accomplishment and milestone for their child. The second thing that I want to mention is that the exposure to data and evidence occurred very early in our household. In 1964, the Surgeon General's report on tobacco, one of the first reports on tobacco, came out. And my father had been a lifelong smoker. And I was 14 years old at the time, so you can calculate how old I am today. And overnight, he stopped smoking because of that report. And I thought, what could be more powerful than data and information? Now, it's taken me a number of decades to understand that knowledge is very powerful, but insufficient for many of us to really create behavioral change. But without knowledge, without having scientific evidence, we're not going to be able to make any of those changes. I have a dear friend who sometimes gets up and says, you know, I've lost 50 pounds. She's about my height. And, of course, everyone in the audience says, 50 pounds? How do, you know, what did you do? She said, it's the same 5 pounds 10 times. So she knows what it takes to go on a diet. But understanding the patterns are very, very complex. The second thing that occurred very early when I was an undergrad was I, too, had the idealism of saving the world by becoming a social worker. I could not think about a better profession, and I was a sociology major at UCLA. And then the women's health movement and the availability of the birth control pill really was an instrumental, revolutionary moment in our society. What could be more powerful than helping men and women decide how many children and when in their lives they would have them? And that shifted my thinking from becoming a social worker to moving into public health. And as an undergrad at UCLA, we had to have a field project. And I hope for the undergrads who are here, I just feel like that's a very important experience, because as I spoke Spanish and my parents were LA court translators for over 20 years, so they would always come home with all of these stories about social injustice of what happened to the immigrants they were serving. But working in the Barrio Free Clinic, at the time the Free Clinic movement was very important, gave me an opportunity to start teaching in Spanish to Latina women about birth control. And I saw the level of dis-ease that was happening among these women who just could not feel comfortable about talking about birth control in a public kind of a way. And as part of my master's degree, I had the opportunity to work at Venice Free Clinic, which allowed me to be a medical aide. And I can say to you that it was very inspiring to me to be with Latina patients and to help them and translate for them and serve, much like my parents did, in the kind of element way so that their services could be improved. Because we know that language, literacy, and ability to communicate become such an important factor in the quality of care that you've already heard about. Now, at the time, at this clinic, they were developing, they were testing new methods of birth control pills. At that time, in the early 70s, birth control pills were very high dosage. And this clinic was part of a clinical trial to try and test a lower dosage. So I, as a Latina, thought, my people are being coerced. I have to study. Who are in these studies? Are they getting adequate informed consent? So I actually did my thesis and interviewed 100 women to find out who was in these studies. And shocking to me, and this is another part of my insight, is to be careful about your stereotypes. Because it turned out that none of the 100 women were Latinas. In fact, the clinic was so careful about trying to get, quote unquote, those clients that they thought would be more compliant with a clinical trial than to engage and enroll Latinas who may be migrating, who might be leaving, who would not be part of the study. So I noticed or saw that, in fact, these were clients who were highly motivated, had tried other methods of contraception, were going to UCLA but living in the Venice area. And so the study was not enrolling the women in which this product eventually would be used. But it also helped me to understand that it's not always what you think will happen. There is coercion, there is sexism, there's racism, but you have to do your data gathering to understand further. It was around this time that I became very interested in the whole area of adolescence and adolescent pregnancy and pregnancy prevention. And it became very important for me to really understand what was going on in the context of the lives of these young people. And at the time, lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and worked with Bob Hatcher, who many of you know is the director or started contraceptive technology, which is the Bible in this field. And he was an amazing mentor because he really provided me with many new opportunities to fly my wings. I had just been a recent Master's of Public Health student from UCLA and had moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and we put on the first conference on teenage pregnancy and pregnancy prevention May 24th, 1974. So you can see that this has been an issue that I've been involved in for a very long time. But underneath this, I needed to understand, why is it that young women were getting pregnant? What could we do to help them? Couldn't we just give them more birth control? And it was during this period that I began to realize how complex all of this was. And insight number three is to really start delving and developing a depth versus a breadth of an issue. You heard from our wonderful, wise women here. But I would say that all of them would say that earlier in your career, you want to become a known expert in a particular nuanced slice. You want to understand the history. You want to understand the trends, the literature, the past policy decisions, the theoretical underpinnings. And having that as your anchor becomes a very important bridge for you to be able to conquer many other topics. But if you're not well known and respected within at least one body of content of area, then you have very little to stand on. Now, each of these areas are so complex that they're clustered in the same way that Margarita was sharing with you, that there is, if you look at the 30,000-point view, there will be ways that this clusters. But I encourage you to become an expert, because then people will start turning to you for the advice and expertise. And it was this expertise that I developed initially in teenage pregnancy, but more in the whole area of adolescence and understanding the influences on adolescent health that has really helped me. And here is a iceberg, because part of what I tried to do in my research was to say, it's not just the behavior you see on the surface. It's what is underneath at the individual, the school, the community, the policy level that shapes the people's behavior. Because we can't just blame adolescents for their behavior without us taking full responsibility for what's going on. I want to move now into my life as a translator of research into policy. This is my favorite photo of the Golden Gate Bridge, not far from where I work. And the power of mentors has already been mentioned as very influential. Not only do they offer support in very large and small measures, but they provided many opportunities early and frequently in your life. They provide a way for you to build confidence. And let me say that as an immigrant, it's very difficult to eliminate one's negative self-esteem. When I was in the Cleveland schools, I belonged in the third grade. I was put in the first grade for several months just so that I could learn how to speak English. And there was, at the time, even though I'm very short, at the time I was taller than a lot of the other first graders. And so I was in the back of the room, and there was this young other girl who one day turned to me and said, "Gee, you must be awfully stupid to be here." And it has taken me many years to recognize that somewhere in the back of my mind, I am still trying to prove to that girl that I'm not so stupid. I don't know her name, I don't know where she is, but I'm just saying to you that a mentor, the power of not just one mentor, but many mentors, can really give you that level of support as well as the energy when you're disheartened. One of my favorite mentors is Phil Lee, who is 89 years old and who we have named our institute in his honor. And at this institute, we work on evidence-based health policy. We work on having, it's like almost like a mini IOM, by having the diverse disciplines and building relationships. And he's been a very important element in my life. He helped to start Medicaid and Medicare when he worked for President Johnson. Another reflection is finding one's research passion and discovering tools for potential policy implications and directions. And this is a whole process that I think is really important. For me, it's very much not being happy with just having the research, unless I am playing an activist role in the translation of that research for different kinds of audiences, helping to assure, without using the word advocacy, but information sharing in ways that people can understand it so that they really can begin to do and shape different policies. And because of time, I will skip to say that I've done work in the area of parental notification, in the area of investing in adolescent health, in improving the health of adolescents and young adults. All this time, though, across this whole panel and others will say to you, it's extremely important for us to be better, to be more rigorous of our research and standards and practices. We need to educate others about the importance of having college opportunities for our next leaders in this field, but we need to be sure that our science is rigorous. This is just a little cartoon for some humor. Thank you, sir, and would you like to be added to my database? One big study that I've been involved in, and I'll close soon, is a study of our family planning program in California, the Family Pact program. And here is another opportunity where I've worked to break negative stereotypes of Latinas and Latinos. Two-thirds of our patients, because we've been told, oh, Latinas don't use family planning. Two-thirds of our patients are Latina. Half of them are speaking Spanish in our clinics, and a substantial proportion of them are below 100% of poverty. That's Mr. Cray conducting research. And I just want to say that scientific integrity, conflict of interest is very important. As Rosemary alluded to, we've had within the IOM many controversies to deal with, and it's our job to bring the best evidence to bear. And one real particularly proud moment was when we developed the Clinical Preventive Services recommendations for women to eliminate copayment for contraceptive care and for annual wellness visits. And those have been incorporated into the ACA. More recently, I've also participated in a number of other projects, one of them now around young adult health. And finally, I want to say that don't forget that you need sustained dedication. You need the patience and Sisyphus approach. And some of you know the myth of Sisyphus, when the rock is pushed to the top, the rock comes down. And I would get very depressed about this rock and how you could start, you know, always at the same place. And the reality is that one of my teachers, maybe he made this up, but helped me by saying, you know, the rock, when it comes all the way down, doesn't stop or doesn't end at the exact moment you began. It's usually a couple of inches further. And finally, I want to say to all of you, this is a scene from one of my favorite movies. I think the work that we bring, the lens that we bring as Latinas and Latinos to this work, takes a lot of brains. It also takes a lot of heart, and it takes a lot of courage. Those were all just terrific stories. Thank you for sharing them with us. And so now, really, this is about you. Anybody who wants to ask a question and begin that dialogue with these incredible women?
First of all, let me say I want
other comments, or could you introduce yourself first?
Yeah, sure. My name is Lena Ramirez. I'm an assistant professor of public health at the University of California in Merced, and I just started a few months ago after post-acute NCI. And I guess that one, thank you. It is just so awesome to be in a room full of people like us. And thank you for being where you are and leading the trail. And then I guess the question I have is, it's more of the word. What are some good strategies that you have? My work focuses on understanding communication and designing communication campaigns and messages to be effective for that, across the administration spectrum and taking into account lots of things. And when I tell people what I do, in general, they're oh, good, that's something that's important. And then it kind of stops and they move on to the next person. And then when I get presentation, no one shows up. And people don't, because, they just can't find the time because it's not a priority for them. And I know it's important work. I hope you all agree with me because it's important work. But I guess the question is, have you experienced that? And what are some good strategies to get over it and get people interested? Because I need them to be interested. They need the money.
Well, you should look at the I don't watch a lot of web facing because I'm ADD, I guess. But this one is worth one. It's the science of the science of communication. If you ever doubted your field and saw that those two webinars, you would be saying, oh my God, I'm so happy I'm in this area. Because it happened the opposite. I was like, why didn't I get into this area earlier? So you should definitely watch those two webinars. They're some of the best things that it's so good. They have people talking about the importance of how can we provide science, that we talk about climate change and people don't still believe it. I mean, what's wrong with our nation? And sort of talking why people, even if you give the communication, it just doesn't come in. And it's just a perfect way to talk to the
public. That's a really good idea. And I would also, as you ask, that you come up with some very concrete translation of what you're doing. And get some of your participants in your study and develop a brief film. And put it on the web, on the website. I'm just saying to you that YouTube is an amazing channel for communication. But I think being able to translate your research into something that has traction with your audience as to why, even you could use humor to show people, not communicating effectively, and with your techniques, communicating effectively.
I wondered whether you're doing your work in a specific health outcome, because since everybody is so focused on specific health outcomes as a result of how NIH is organized, that if you're presenting information about communication without a specific outcome, as an example, people may have a harder time relating what you have to offer to what they're doing, so maybe trying to apply some of your work to outcomes that people are interested in.
Tremendous job from the University of Illinois at Chicago. First of all, I really thank you so much for sharing your personal stories. I'm an immigrant from Palestinian background, so I'm not a Latino. I might look like that. I have a degree, my peer
I'll give you my opinion. I think that, you know, you should own your interest in this area and, you know, explain or be able to talk about what interests you in terms of the particular area, whether it's from a social justice perspective or from a research perspective or combination. And this is who you are, and this is the interest you came to have. So I think kind of getting over that is important, so you don't feel like you have to be apologizing. And then think about what is it that you want to contribute. What is it that you want to contribute? And I think collaborate, getting to know the community obviously is very important. Being part of other groups that know about the population, that know about the research methods, that know about the health outcomes you're interested in, is important. But it kind of sounded, I sense your discomfort with questions about who you are doing the work you're doing, because somehow feeling that you're being questioned about it because you're not Latino. So, you know, we need everybody who has the right intentions and the right skills to contribute to solutions in our communities. At least that's how I see it. And once you take that on, then you have the responsibility to do informed work, which means, you know, learning about the population as well as the method, you know, the scientific.
I also appreciate you asking, and I really think that your authentic self is extremely important, because you're not there to rip off the community, you're there to bring data and evidence to help make changes. I do think that having partnerships with community individuals, finding what I call positive deviants, that are the individuals living in those communities that are not developing asthma, and learning from them as well, and then really working in partnership to highlight the achievements and also the progress that can be made. But your authentic self and the skills that you're bringing in an unselfish way will come shining through.
I just wanted to first apologize for being here. I was at the Bill Nathan lecture.
You should call yourself other scientists, even the American Public Health Association, they teach the design for all Latino scientists. And they told me that should be the first conference. So I was like, next time. So this one, so people sometimes are going to question the population that you study. And in my case, my interest is Latina coffee here. So it's not because I'm Latina, my concentration in coffee cup was maternal shelter. So I tell people, I'm interested in all women.
More broadly on the issue of what's our role, I've always felt, much like what you're saying, Claire, what I know you've done, Margarita, that our role is not finished when we publish a paper, but that we have a responsibility, at least I feel, you know, are we publishing to have an impact, or are we publishing to have a paper, in another paper in the bookshelf? So I've always taken that part very seriously, and in my own areas of work, for example, when I was in Boston, I worked closely with the city and the state health departments and with the legislature around changing practices related to integrated care, which is the area I was working in, substance abuse, mental health, and trauma, getting changes in licensing, licensed treatment facilities so that they're required and trained staff to provide integrated care, especially care for people with a history of trauma, to make some changes in the our practices in the criminal justice system in the state in terms of how people with mental illness are treated when they're incarcerated. So I think in our own work with the community, the recovering community, we held every year an event at the State House where we invited all legislators and we trained women in recovery to go and talk to their legislators about issues in the budgets that are coming up for a vote, et cetera. So we're developing a cadre of people who can also speak on their own behalf. So I feel like that's part of our role, to educate, to use the information, knowledge we generate to educate and inform policy.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add briefly that it's important for you to keep your credibility as a researcher, because you bring credibility, for example, when you testify in front of Congress or testify in Georgia House, you're there as a researcher, and it's important for you to be able to have the integrity that if you found, let's say, that immigration policy is good for the people, but I'm just making this bizarre comment, it would be our responsibility to report that as well as results that we want to find. So I would suggest that we keep that integrity, but also think about how to translate your research papers into briefs that have the authenticity of having a university researcher having conducted the work, because many of your advocates and the network of advocates can then use your data and can quote you as the source of information that gives credibility to the issue that we're trying to solve. Now that's your 9 to 5 or 9 to 8. And weekends and night is when you can also write letters, you can also get people to write, do more of a quote-unquote advocacy work. But I do feel that there's a very important role. You know, there's such a small cadre of Latino, Latina researchers. Only 10% of Latinos go on to college. And so you have to really weigh your role and how and where you can make the greatest impact.
I do think that a role that we haven't played very well as researchers is actually trying to influence policy by our research. And I think that now more and more we're trying to do that, trying to take the message, you know, whatever message it is that we're doing in terms of research, but trying to bring it to policy matters. They invited me, for example, to be part of the National Academy of State Health Policy, and at the beginning I told them, there, I'm a researcher, and everyone, I'm the only researcher, by the way. And so it's been really a good intersection of seeing how will policymakers think researchers actually give them information that's usable for them. It's really changed my mind as a researcher. So I think more having that intersection is really important.
Okay, we'll make this the last one. And just the last thing I wanted to say is I wanted to point out that actually this session was organized by Hortensia, and it comes as a response to hearing the need at the Latino Caucus about sessions around mentoring, and so we heard it. She took the lead in organizing it, and thank you all for coming.
Excellent.
Was it good?
You're terrific.
How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You too.